Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to Coast AM. I am Dave Schrader. Our guest this evening, Patricia Pearson, is an award-winning journalist, novelist, and humorist whose probing books have earned her a reputation for upending conventional wisdom. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Huffington Post, Business Week, and on NPR, among many other media outlets. A former member of USA Today's op-ed board of contributors, she directed the research for the 2009 History Channel documentary, The Science of the Soul. Her TEDx talks include Why Ghosts Are Good for You, pointing to the research that shows how important experiences with unexplained phenomena can be in helping people cope with their grief. She's based in Toronto. Her new book is called Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. Prompted by her own family's surprising, profound experiences around the death of her father and her sister, reporter Patricia Pearson set out on an open-minded inquiry, a rare journalistic investigation of nearing-death awareness. Pearson discovers that roughly half of bereaved people, as well as nurses, hospice workers, soldiers, and others who constantly observe the dying, have had intimations of enduring bonds that can radically help people to process their grief and fear. Opening Heaven's Door offers deeply affecting stories of messages from the dying and the dead in a fascinating work of investigative journalism, pointing to a new scientific explanations that give these luminous moments the importance felt by those who experience them. Pearson also delves into out-of-body and near-death experiences, examining stories and research to make sense of these related but distinct categories that shed light on nearing-death awareness. We'll cover all of that and more on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. And I'd like to take a quick second before we return to the show this evening to ask that all of the Coast to Coast listeners around the world say a little extra prayer this evening for the families of the two Metro police officers that were gunned down in Las Vegas today. Another senseless act of violence, and it has shaken the Vegas community. So if you could please keep those officers and their families and the community in your thoughts and prayers and send them positive energy, I know it would go a long way. And let's just hope for a peaceful ending to this violence that seems to be cropping up all around the world. Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. Patricia Pearson is our guest this evening. Patricia, thank you again for being here with us.
Hi, Dave.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the different aspects of the dying process and the awareness of it. Do you find in any of the research that you've done that people that had no idea that they were about to die would suddenly be awakened to it, or will start to notice or pick up on these things days, weeks, maybe even months before it actually occurs?
Yeah. So there's in some of the studies that have been done, doctors will, and paramedics as well, will remark on the fact that they'll have somebody that they had absolutely no prognosis for them that was fatal. So, you know, they'd had a heart attack, but they were recovering, or they had pneumonia, but they were stable, or some other, you know, or they just had hip surgery or something like that. And then the person will either see somebody who's died, like have that takeaway vision where it's suddenly somebody's materializing to them who's predeceased them, and they'll be very surprised, and then will die within the day, or indeed within a couple of hours. Or they will say, I'm going to die, I'm going away. They'll start using that language of journey, even though it makes no sense in a medical context. And palliative care physicians sometimes talk about the mystery of that. Like, they're fascinated by how that could be. So there's no correlation between the actual sort of physical state and somehow this intimation that people have that, you know, that they're about to go on some kind of journey. So yeah, that does happen. It's a mystery.
And then you get people kind of on the other side of the spectrum. I mean, you know, there's that movie series Final Destination, where people that seem to cheat death have it revisited unto them. Or, I mean, Seth MacFarlane, I guess, is one of the best examples. If I understand this correctly, and I can have my engineer do a little research on this during the break, but I believe Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy and the movie Ted and the new Million Ways to Die in the West, he was supposed to be on one of the planes that crashed on 9/11.
Oh, really?
And yeah, something came up and kept him from going. And you hear stories like that where people just get an inkling before this happens and they don't go. And it you know, everybody else dies aboard this plane or, you know, in the accident that took place. And there's no rational explanation for why the person didn't go that day. They weren't sick. There was no other reason. They just didn't go.
Yeah. I talked to one guy, I remember, who he actually had a dream of the flight that he was supposed to take the next day. It was like a little twin prop plane. And in the dream, he knew exactly who was sitting beside him on either side in front of him, how they were reacting to the plane crashing, you know, who was talking to one of the other passengers very calmly, who was very hysterical, really, really vivid, played out scenario. And so he didn't get on the plane, but at the same time, you know, he thought he was crazy to be like losing his, you know, his airfare that he'd paid. And the plane did crash, and then he had, you know, a really strong sort of almost a nervous breakdown over the, you know, the revelation that that was a real precognitive event. And what did it mean? And he had survivor guilt around it, too, you know. So there is some element of that. And one of the things I find interesting is when you talk to people who've had near-death experiences, and they inevitably they will come to some threshold or border where they're told it's not their time. And I was always wondering, well, what does that mean? So does that mean that when you have that precognitive moment and you're Seth MacFarlane and you don't take that direction, is it because it's not your time? And I mean, is that what's actually going on? Is that, you know, we're sort of somehow slightly directed in terms of when we're supposed to die? I mean, it's a huge mystery. I don't know. It's really interesting.
I guess according to what the Coast listeners are pounding my email with, Mark Wahlberg was also supposed to be a part of that flight and to be flying out with Seth MacFarlane. And it was American Airlines Flight 11. And
wow.
It was supposed to be a keynote speaker at his alma mater, the Rhode Island School of Design in Rhode Island. And his travel agent told him his flight would leave Logan Airport at 8:15 a.m. And when it was actually scheduled to depart at 7:45, MacFarlane arrived a few minutes late and didn't end up getting on that flight.
I think that would just be the most haunting experience, don't you think?
Right. Well, you get, and then it's called, I believe, survivor guilt. And,
yeah.
And a lot of people have to go through that. And, you know, there's so much to be said for, is there something outside the normal going on in these cases, you know, random number generators around the world that have been positioned, started to pick up on this tragedy long before it happened, picked up on the death of Michael Jackson before it happened and before it was announced. People had this kind of global consciousness or awareness come to them. So it doesn't seem so out of the ordinary that people would, in effect, you know, have these moments in their own life, if that timeline is being touched, that they would have some sense of this going on or have an experience. I believe Elvis was also one that kind of knew when he was going to die and talked about that he would die in that year and had visions of that since he was younger, that would be the age he would pass.
I assume he didn't plan to die in the bathroom.
No, I don't think anybody'd set that whole deal up. But yeah, it's funny to hear these stories where people do it. Now, are they self-fulfilling prophecies because that becomes a focus for them? And they put that out there. Do they, in a sense, die of a broken heart, as you mentioned earlier with your father? You know, can we have that deep of an impact in our own physicality simply by the things that we think about?
That's a really interesting question. It's like the opposite of a placebo effect, right?
Right.
The nocebo effect. But I think, like, one of the things I looked at in when I was researching this book was people who have these sensed presence experiences when they're in the midst of battle, like in World War I and World War II. And, you know, there are cases, for instance, where one guy was in a bivvy and he was asleep and his deceased brother woke him up. He felt the warmth of his hand on his face and said, you know, get up, get up. You, we've got to go. And, you know, he was you know, half asleep, and he was baffled, and he just kind of blindly followed his brother and ran out of the trench, and then the bivvy that he was in was annihilated by a shell, and four other people were in that, and they were all annihilated, but his brother, who was dead, had somehow led him to safety. So is that, you know, a kind of vivid example of this sense of sometimes it's people's time and sometimes it's not, or is that a coincidence, or, you know, it's such an enduring kind of question to try to unravel.
Right. And then, you know, it points you into it's one of those, you know, Pandora's box of questions as you delve deeper into it. Are we truly being helped by the spirit of a loved one? Is it an angelic form that's taking the image of somebody that we would know and recognize and trust so that we don't maybe question it? Or is it our mind picking up on the sense that there's an impending doom and it fires off a memory of a face that we would recognize and take more seriously? You know, kind of our fight or flight acknowledgement and our body making us aware of the situation by playing these things out.
Yeah, almost like the way your alarm clock goes into your dream and becomes a church bell. So there's a real exterior signal, but your brain is processing it almost instantaneously into some other kind of meaningful narrative. So, you know, maybe it could be that.
Right, and that's the whole thing. We just don't understand about consciousness and what are we encountering. Mm-hmm. Are we truly dealing with the dead? Are we dealing with ghosts? Are we dealing with a heavenly intervention helping us? Or are these all part of our system's protective nature? You know, something that sets us off to alert us to situations. I remember very vividly in January 1st of 1988, a month before my son was to be born, New Year's Eve, I'd stayed out late and hung with friends and decided I'd be the sober cab that night and drove everybody home. And every time I passed my parents' street, my hair stood up on end. I had chills. I had flashes, visions of my mother being wheeled out and put into an ambulance. And there was no reason for this. My mom was healthy and doing great. And it kept perplexing me all night long, just this sense of impending doom. I'm not a psychic. I'm not a sensitive. I'm not mediumistic. But around 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, it got so bad, I was supposed to stay at a friend's house. I said, I've got to go home. And I just packed up and went home. My mother shuffled out to meet me in the living room, one eye squinting and, you know, everything okay? Yeah, Mom, I'm fine. Stayed home. You know, she goes, I'll be right back. I'm going to go to the bathroom. She turned around and collapsed in the hallway and went into a massive grand mal seizure.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, all night I've been seeing these visions, all night. As I passed by the street, I literally felt like a telephone line being plugged right into my head, giving me visions of what happened. Now, thankfully, it was just a one-time seizure she never experienced again, and they have no idea why or what occurred to create that one-time experience, but it did. Mm-hmm. And you start to realize just how connected we truly are to one another. And this, I don't know if it's an energetic field, Akashic field, or whatever we're dealing with, but we do have a collective consciousness that seems to put us together. And if we start to pay attention to it, will we notice it more?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it does seem to wobble a little bit in terms of the time dimension. And there's actually some really solid research out of Cornell now by a clinical psychologist, Daryl Bem, on showing people, images of scary images to psychology students that flash on a computer screen, but then they monitor their physical reaction to the image, and they realize that they're having the physical fright response before the image is actually on the screen.
Right, which they're actually playing that into the idea of what deja vu is. Right, it's a buffering system that the brain does, and sometimes there's a hiccup, and you're not actually experiencing something that you dreamed about or had that experience, but for once you're having the experience before the memory comes to you of it.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, much like a CD player in the way it has that skip guard. It's actually playing ahead 10 seconds, so when you hit the bump, it just automatically picks right up and you never miss that beat.
Right.
And I've heard that that's a similar way to how they're trying to explain the deja vu phenomena is just a little skip, and that they're finding that the body is responding prior to being pricked by a needle or other uncomfortable moments, and it seems it knows long before you do what's coming.
Yeah, that's right.
and I shouldn't say long before, sometimes it's as few as a few split seconds, but your body does react as though it's already occurred before the consciousness accepts the reality of the situation.
Yeah. And they're also doing this research with like zebra finches and different kinds of animals and stuff and getting the same results. So, you know, I think that it's really exciting to me the way that science is beginning to kind of stop, you know, just dismissing things out of hand and actually begin to look at it with an open mind and some interesting kind of, you know, experiments and studies, because people continue to have these experiences and they don't want to be told that they're foolish, because there's nothing foolish about thinking that your mother is going to have a grand mal seizure and it happening and you being there because you were alerted to it.
It puts you in that situation, though, of being there. What to what end? What was, you know, it's one of those when you do have that psychic moment and you get it, but it wasn't able to do anything. I didn't save my mom. It didn't do anything. You know, would she have had it had I not come home, and she would have woken up, and would it have just happened in her sleep and she would have been fine and it would have gone unnoticed? You know, it seems strange to me sometimes that these experiences happen. What do we learn from them? Do we truly get anything from this?
Well, maybe you don't need to get something from them. Maybe it's just the sheer act of connectivity that makes you aware. Some of the research that's done on people who respond to the distress signals of people they love distinguish it from worrying about somebody by the conviction. So the fact that the people will, like, drive home, or in your case, do what you did. So there's an action taken. There's a phone call made. There's something very specific where, you know, you're really reaching across time and space out of love and concern for somebody. And, you know, that's pretty much the extent of what matters about it, really.
Have you taken a stance after doing the research for this book on the theory and belief in reincarnation? Does it play into what you add in this book or understand from what comes next?
I don't know. Certainly when you interview people who've had really deep near-death experiences, they will say that it's their understanding that they will be reincarnated. Although the most interesting comment I got actually was from this one woman who's now in her 80s, and she had a really amazing NDE in 1952 during childbirth. And I said, well, you know, based on what you went through, do you think that we are reincarnated? And she said, yeah, but we're not just reincarnated to this earth. You know, we can be reincarnated anywhere in the universe. You know, who are we to think that the planet Earth is the only important thing in a spiritual universe? And for some reason, it never occurred to me in a million years, and I just thought that was like, oh, okay, yeah, why not? You know, we don't necessarily traffic our souls back into this particular, you know, highway of life. My metaphors are deteriorating as we approach 4 in the morning.
when people have experiences with astral projection, is there any correlation or any data that supports that people that, you know, have these seem to have a clearer, more vivid near-death experiences or leading up to death experiences? I'm just curious, as people that report astral projection all the time, if they're that much more in touch with the astral form or soul energy or whatever you want to call it, do they notice anything?
You mean people who have out-of-body experiences?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of whether they have a different sense of, like, are they more likely to have an NDE, do you mean?
Right, yeah. I'm just curious if there's been any research or have you found anything that would, you know, corroborate those type of connections?
No, not necessarily. One connection that I find quite remarkable is that people who have near-death experiences, as well as people who are advanced meditators, are more likely in the aftermath to become psychic and to have synesthesia, right? So, you know, when you have that the blending of the senses, so that you see colors or you hear colors as musical notes, or you hear sounds in terms of visuals and that kind of thing. So it's almost like something happens to their wiring through these cultivation, either through meditation or through the sort of accidental mysticism of an NDE, where they, it's almost like their mind begins to expand beyond the usual infrastructure of the brain, and I start to be able to perceive in a much more profound, sort of all-encompassing way, which is, you know, also, I keep saying everything's interesting, but it is.
No, definitely. It's a fascinating subject. Our guest, Patricia Pearson, her new book, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. We'll be opening up phone lines after the top of the hour, and you can share your stories and questions with our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast listener Rhonda writes in, as an experienced out-of-body traveler, I would like to add that sometimes it is not deceased friends or family who first greet a recently dead person, but another living person. I can affirm this from personal experience, having been out of body when drawn to a location where someone recently deceased was in spirit, unaware that they had just been killed in a car accident, and it became my role to lead them to the light, waiting to receive them. Interestingly, the spirit had a familiarity with me, yet she did not know me in this lifetime. She was delighted to see me after such a long time, and we embraced warmly before the situation became clear to myself first, then her. This person was someone renowned, and I knew her, although there was no reason for her to know me other than a kindred spirit soulmate relationship and or family genealogy research shows a distant familiar blood tie between us. Those are just things to muse about. Also, the person who died with her in the car accident was also there, but the light was for her alone. When she wanted that person to join her, I became aware that he had things to do yet here on earth before moving on. It goes to say he has remained here in spirit for his own reasons. 20 years ago, my grandfather, who had been deceased for about 9 years, came to me in a dream when two young boys were playing in a field where we were standing and chatting. Each of the boys came up to me and gave me a hug and ran off through the field toward a wooded area. My grandfather smiled and told me not to worry, it wasn't their time. I had been pregnant with twins and due for an ultrasound the next day. The ultrasound found no heartbeats, and a week later, I miscarried twin boys. At 15, I awoke one night wondering why. There was nothing I could really pinpoint as the cause. As I lay there trying to get back to sleep, I suddenly sensed that my great-grandpa Joe had died and was trying to say goodbye. In the still of the night, I whispered goodbye to him, feeling a little stupid, I might add. At breakfast the next morning, the phone rang, family members calling to say Grandpa Joe had died unexpectedly of a heart attack during the night. Those are just a few little stories that validate and support both what Patricia is talking about and your own dream experience, too. All the best from Rhonda in Ontario. When we come back, we'll continue speaking with Patricia Pearson. Her book, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. And we'll take your calls at the top of the next hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening and welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. And if you're intrigued by all things strange and supernatural, then I'd like to invite you to join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central Time, as we explore monsters, myths, legends, conspiracies, and more on Darkness Radio. And then you can keep your dial right there. Listen right through darknessradio.com. And after our show, George Norrie and Coast to Coast AM continues your journey into the strange. This evening, our guest is Patricia Pearson, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. That's the name of her brand new book. Here's another quick little interesting email I just received. Hi, Dave. Once I was at leadership training in Washington, D.C. in high school, and one night we went out to the movies. From the time we left the hotel until the beginning of the movie, I felt very uncomfortable, and I couldn't stop thinking about my brother. I felt like something was wrong. The feeling got so bad that 15 minutes into the movie, I went to the lobby and called my brother. He didn't answer, so I called my mom. She told me my brother had just been held up at gunpoint in a park by our house. He was okay, but they took his wallet and cell phone. I felt so sick, I skipped the movie and went back to the hotel. I had to wait a few days until I flew back home, but when I did, I gave him the biggest hug ever, and that's from Nick in New Mexico. It is amazing how we have these familiar ties to one another, and that almost like a spider web, the way it pings, and we can feel these vibrations and know when there is something upsetting a friend, relative, loved one, when we're not even with them.
Yeah, and actually the father of modern neuroscience, the guy who invented the EEG, did so because he was trying to figure out how it was that his sister had picked up on the fact that he was nearly run over by a horse-drawn cannon. So this would have been in the late 19th, early 20th century. And she had her father, their father, send a telegraph to urgently find out what had happened to him. And he was so fascinated by that that he actually went on to invent the electroencephalogram, right? So to try, he was convinced that they could figure out by, you know, measuring the electrical activity in the brain how this could be happening. And that sort of impulse ultimately has led to some very recent research on EEGs correlating between twins.
I've heard too from some experts that believe those moments when we phase out, when we, you know, we all have it where we're there, we're wide awake and conscious, but we just kind of go out to the, you know, ether. And they believe that what we're doing is pinging those webs constantly. And in those moments, sometimes that's when we're most receptive to collect messages that may be coming back from our connections to all of the people that we meet throughout our lives.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. And I think, you know, in traditional cultures that have less kind of surround sound noise, less stimulus, less sort of ambient kind of sound and emotion and busyness, arguably are still more attuned to some of that. It's easier for them to access some of that information than, you know, it is for me in downtown Toronto, you know. So and it doesn't have anything to do with telepathy per se. It's like you're saying, it has to do with something that we constantly have access to. It's not like a transmission of messages back and forth between special people who claim to be psychic. It's just, it's like we're all in a pool and you drop a pebble in that pool and everywhere you can feel the ripples. So it's just whether or not you're able to sense those ripples.
You did a TED talk on why ghosts are good for you, kind of pointing to the research that shows how important experiences with the unexplained phenomena can actually be in helping people cope with their grief. Talk to us a little bit about that and about death and why we seem to need or want or desire to transcend death and have these messages either related back to us or relate messages going forward to other loved ones. What do you find in all this research?
Well, I mean, it used to be very common in basically all of human history for people to perceive the dead, for the dead to essentially be walking around through the lives of the living. There was ancestor worship. There was a connection to your lost loved ones. You didn't really perceive them as completely lost. And what happened was that kind of got switched around with Freud, and it became this idea that if you continue to want to connect to the dead, then that's pathological. You're being crazy. You're being unhealthy. It's not good for you. You have to let go. And it was this whole idea of the breaking bonds model of grieving that, you know, you wouldn't really get, you needed to get over it, basically. And it's only recently that they've started to realize that that's just not the case. And that, in fact, in cultures where they still have a connection to their ancestors or their lost ones who choose to perceive a sensed presence as what it is for them, which is that person that they love, they're more resilient. They get over their deeper, sort of more complicated feelings of grief more easily because really, what is grief about? It's about, you know, wanting to stay connected. It's about, for me, it's about missing my sister and my father. It's not about death anxiety. It's about missing them and wanting them to still be in my life and I in theirs. And so by changing around the way that we understand some of these phenomena, we give people permission to feel that connection still. I think it's called the enduring bonds approach now. And to me, it's everything. It's like, you know, who are we to deny people some of those incredible experiences and tell them it's all in their heads?
When we talk about death and the ending of the physical connection, and here we're talking about people that over cities, states, sometimes countries can feel that energetic shift, the end of someone's life before it's even known. And I know my co-host on Darkness Radio, my engineer here, Tim Dennis, he has quite a few of those experiences where family members will come to him prior to their death or prior to the rest of the family knowing that they're gone and giving these messages and making these moments, if you will. But what's always so intriguing is sometimes it's even family members we're not very close with. Is there any idea of why some people continually get these messages while others don't?
I don't know. You know, and then in that case, you have to sort of begin to kind of contemplate mediumship. And what is the difference between, you know, the average person who's, you know, deeply connected to people in their family having these experiences, you know, on a one-off basis, versus somebody who says that they see and perceive, you know, everybody. What does that mean? What's the difference? And the research that's sort of the most cutting edge on that is coming out of Brazil, which has the highest per capita number of mediums in the world for reasons best known to Brazilians. I don't know why that is, but so they do a lot of research on that. And they're trying to figure out what is the difference? What's the difference between a medium and a schizophrenic, for instance? Like how do you distinguish between one set of auditory signals and another, or sense presences here versus there? What's the difference between being psychic versus being a medium? How are you picking up on the message of a deceased person versus what is in the memory of the person that you're talking to? You know, how do you figure out those differences? And there's still a lot of research that needs to be done for sure. I feel like I'm developing laryngitis in the midst of your show.
Well, I appreciate you hanging in with us, and we're going to open up phone lines. We'll drive them in the next hour here, letting the listeners share some of their personal encounters and stories. And if they have questions, Patricia will take those in the next hour. What is it that the majority of people nearing death see? Is it always friends and relatives? Is there an even split between friends and relatives, strangers, or what we would consider to be angels?
Sometimes it can be religious figures, depending on the culture. So in India, they might see what's called, I think they're called a Yamdut, or a Yamtut. One of your listeners might correct that, which is a sort of a messenger of death. Whereas here, you might see, a figure of the Virgin Mary, perhaps, or like a Marian apparition. But more commonly than a religious figure, it would be deceased friends, relatives, people that you haven't seen in 40 years but went to elementary school with. It's pretty rare for it to be a stranger in the way that Rhonda was talking about in her email to you, or at least I haven't come across that so much. One story I came across that was pretty unusual was this guy in World War II who was actually in India. He was a British soldier, and he was in India, and he almost sort of slightly passed out in the heat and felt as if he was having a dream. And in the dream, he found himself on the muddy grasses of France, and he saw one of his close friends from England who was fighting on that front, who had been wounded, and the Red Cross train was getting away from him. And so the guy in India, in his dream, dragged the guy and made sure he got to the Red Cross tent. And then the two of them met up after the war, and the guy who'd been in Europe said, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I think you saved my life during the war. He said, what do you mean? He said, well, somehow, like, you came to me in this kind of out-of-body way and dragged me to this tent. And the guy who was in India was so shocked that he just didn't say anything. He didn't return the information that he'd had that dream. He just let it go.
Why do you think people are so reticent to share those type of experiences and talk about them openly?
I think that we basically successfully convinced ourselves as a culture that we have to, that we can only be rational, that we can only be scientific, that anything, you know, subjective or personal or emotional is somehow not permitted. It's not, you know, we're being sentimental, we're being wishful, we're engaging in fantasies. You know, it's more prestigious. It's more to be rational. And so people guard these experiences because they don't want them stomped on. They don't want people to make fun of them. So I can't tell you the number of times when I was researching this book that people said, I've never told anyone this, but it was amazing the number of people who said that. It's like you have to come out of the closet.
Right. And you'd hope by now, 2014, people would be more open to this. And I think they are. Every place we go, I hear more and more stories, and people do feel comfortable. We'll give you a safe forum in the next hour to call and share your stories here on Coast to Coast AM. We've got about 5 minutes left in this segment. I'd love to hear a couple more of your favorite collected stories in your new book, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After.
Well, some of my favorite ones were, for instance, what's called the third man factor, which is people who are in situations of extreme environmental distress. So they're high up on Mount Everest, or they're, shipwrecked soldiers at sea, not soloists at sea, or they're in the Antarctic and polar expeditions. And it turns out that so many of these people are now reporting these experiences of a sense presence that accompanies them to the point where they're rescued and then vanishes. But it vanishes just before they're rescued. So it's not that it's like an imaginary thing. It's a very comforting, instructing, goading presence that will take them to a place of rescue and then depart. And it happened to Ernest Shackleton, in the Antarctic, and with two of his friends, and they were going across the snow, and all three of them became aware of this accompanying presence till they reached the whaling station, but none of them spoke to each other about it until afterwards. So it's this extraordinary other dimension to this that's only now coming to light as a whole other area of mystery in terms of human experience.
When we approach death, in the stories that you've heard and collected, has it shaped your belief in what happens next? Are you afraid of death?
No, I'm not. I'm not afraid of the dying experience. I don't know where it leads precisely, of course, but I think witnessing my sister, who was my dearest best friend, go into that experience without fear, with a smile on her face, looking radiant, lit from within, taught me something. It taught me something about a world of greater mystery than we understand, that where people are not alone somehow when they die.
And that's, I guess, the comfort that everyone's looking for. My fear has been, since I was literally as young as I can remember back, maybe 4 or 5 years old, laying awake fearful of death. And at the age approaching here, 47 years old, there are still nights that I lie awake, afraid to go to sleep for fear for not waking up. And I, in some instances, I wish that my fear of death would lessen. In other instances, it feels like that's what keeps me pushing forward to try to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
we go.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. It's a knife's edge that you're on.
But the fear of death is so overwhelming for many of us. And even though we hear these amazing stories and these great moments that people share, there's still this fear that it's just physiological. It's just the brain. It's just the way the body interprets what's going on, and shutting down, it fires off memories and thoughts. Because, again, the brain is still so much a mystery to science. Do you ever look on the other side from the skeptical perspective and wonder how much of this is a real spiritual moment as opposed to a breakdown of the human form?
Well, I mean, I think that I really tried to get into that very patiently and systematically in the book itself, and really explain to people that, sure, that could be a possibility, and it could be a possibility in certain circumstances, but there are simply too many circumstances in which what's going on is not really going on in terms of just your brain. So, like, a shared death experience would be one example, right? So people will have this experience where I talked to one woman, her mother was dying, and as her mother literally died, she entered into an experience of the light with her mother. She saw her mother rise up out of her body, and both she and her teenage son actually rose somehow briefly into this kind of light. The whole geometry of the room changed. And this is a woman who was, like, on faculty at Harvard. So, you have to get yourself to the point where all of that can somehow be explained purely by the idea that we're just mechanistic robots with flesh on. And until you get to that point, it's far richer and more you know, way more obvious to say that these are what they present themselves to be, which are meaningful spiritual experiences.
Patricia Pearson, our guest, opening heaven's door. We're going to open up the phone lines and let you shine for the next hour. Share your real life thoughts and stories and encounters and questions with our guests. Stay tuned. Coast to Coast AM continues right after this.